Hey, it's the FinTech Newscast. My name's John, and with me, as always, is Steve. How are you doing?
As always, I'm well, John. How are you? Happy spring.
Happy spring. It is really nice out here in California right now.
Beautiful. Gorgeous.
Yeah. But hopefully a lot of people around the Silicon Valley and San Francisco are keeping their heads down and working hard on AI projects. It seems like it's a bit of a horse race these days. I just saw Microsoft stole some employee for their DeepMind project.
Oh, I did not see that, but it does seem to be the next boom. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. They took, I don't know where they stole him from, Mustafa Suleiman, on the front page of the Wall Street Journal. So I'm going to take that as a big deal.
Is Microsoft really all that? I mean, I know that they have an investment in OpenAI, but are primarily invested in the AI space or no?
Primarily invested. I think everyone's putting a lot of money into it. You know, of course, Microsoft, Amazon, all the big cloud guys are into it. It takes so much power, which NVIDIA is very grateful for. But yeah, besides the OpenAI that we see all the time, plus Elon Musk's project, it seems like a really competitive place. And of course, the dozens of startups that we see around here.
It's the new crypto. But it actually works.
Yeah.
And it actually has a purpose.
Fortunately, and I use this intro a bit, we have someone that knows a lot more than us on this topic. Ronan Donahue, a capital markets and AI consultant with deep experience in finance and AI. Welcome to the podcast.
It's great to be here, guys. Good to be on the show.
Anyone that you see interesting, any players or moves lately that you think are particularly interesting in AI?
Well, you know, I should probably explain to your listeners, you know, my background is as a capital markets banker. So I was in the bond market for 25 years, and I now consult on the sort of intersection of what goes on in the markets and AI. I can explain more about that in a bit. But mostly what I'm focused on is what's going on in that space. I think when you're analyzing AI, you kind of have to cut yourself off to an ecosystem or a subset of that to really see what's happening. And I think one of the big developments in the financial markets in the last year, I detect among the clients I'm dealing with, is that we've reached a tipping point where up until probably 2022, everyone was standing around watching this marketplace and thinking about where it might take them. But last year, with obviously late 22, we had Gen AI come on stream. And then during the course of last year, there was a big development that affected capital markets and I think has nudged them all to get moving on their AI strategy. And that was, you'll probably recall well, the bank failure on the quarter one last year. There was a number of bank failures on the West Coast of America, SVB, being right. The largest.
Oh, yeah. We remember, all right.
You remember that.
And some former colleagues. Yeah, I was at SVB a while ago. Yeah.
And the reason that's still kind of having a ripple effect this side of the pond is because, you know, in all my years in the market, something like that would have remained a regional story and people would have watched it. They'd have heard about it, but it wouldn't have really had any impact on the hundreds of billions flowing through the bond market every day. But in this case, the market stood up because what really caught that bank was liquidity. I think in one afternoon, $40 billion was transferred out of that bank. And the old days, you'd have a queue down the road and around the corner, people were drawing deposits. Now with digital banking, it was just taken out, and it really left big problems for obviously the regulators in the United States and the FDIC and so on. But what happened in the markets was that in Europe, the traders were casting about to know who is similarly vulnerable in Europe. And the big issue with SVB was that the deposits were big. They were lumpy. They were coming from fintech and also from very wealthy individuals. So they just started targeting the wealth providers in Europe. The biggest a casualty was Credit Suisse just a couple of years later. And nothing connected these banks other than the market decided there's a vulnerability in the system and we need to go probing who else might have deposit flight. And then a huge European behemoth, a Swiss bank, lasted only a couple of weeks. And
The reason enough.
Yeah, and the reason that's relevant is because that kicked off, I think, an awful lot of CEOs in the financial sector realized, okay, this is not just something we read in the Financial Times in the journal every day. This is actually the digital transfer of wealth and money it's opened up a vulnerability as well as opportunity in the market, and we have to start, you know, getting our strategy organized. And I think that's been the biggest change. And no names in particular other than those sort of have put their head above the parapet, but there's activity taking place below the water in all of them.
It sounds like this is essentially a function of a speed and technology, but can you maybe walk us through for the listeners who maybe not have been around then, how these two bank failures of Credit Suisse and SVB, how they compare to previous bank failures, and how and what role tech has played in enabling those two things as well?
In the old days, bank failure happened by a panic coming into the market. As recently as the global credit crunch in 2007, there's very familiar footage over here on a bank called Northern Rock that was one of the first to go bust. And it showed all the depositors rushing to the bank to take out their money. Just in that famous film, It's a Wonderful Life, in the 40s, showed a bank. I only saw that for the first time at Christmas, believe it or not. And it was a bank run. It was people coming in, wanting to withdraw their money, and there wasn't enough money to give them. And that's how the failure happened. But you still had to go up to the front desk of the bank, fill out a form and take your money out, or transfer much smaller sums digitally. But in this case, because the deposits were so great, they were so big, people could go online, the depositors, and just move the money very, very quickly. And I think that's the main difference. The fear factor is the same. I think the other bank that it happened to, First Republic, saw 100 billion withdrawn in the first quarter, but Silicon Valley has to take the prize, I think, for 40 billion in a day. But, you know, the funny thing is, Steve, that banks previously looked at wealth management, the like of what Credit Suisse did, as very safe. You know, you think of a Swiss private bank of long standing. And the reason wealth management is very safe is because, you know, the bank isn't loaning money in the way that it would to industry, to consumers, and it mightn't get the money back. That's a risk. But when all you're doing is managing money, you're taking a fee. So banks like wealth management because it gets, the regulators like it too, because there's a lower capital requirement, it's less risky. But guess what? In this case, the thing that we all thought was less risky turned out to be, have another vulnerability, which was that deposit flight could take place very quickly. And I think that really goes back to digital people moving money on their mobile phone and on tablets and so on in a way that would not have been as common in the past. So that was one thing I think that really stands out.
Is there anything we can do in terms of regulation or oversight to make sure that we can decelerate or slow down the progress of these bank failures? Or is the cat basically out of the bag right now?
Yeah. Is it like, do you have to slow down hysteria and fear?
Right.
Put some brakes on it.
I think that in the case of SVB in particular, there's a lot of talk about VCs going on Twitter or X, you know, and essentially saying, you know, get your money out right now and sort of guiding their company so to do the same and pull out of SVB, which I think accelerated the drawdown. So I'm curious, yeah, whether there's anything we can do from a legal or regulatory
perspective. No, it's a good point, and you're not the first to raise it. Well, firstly, for your listeners, banks already have a compendium of rules and regulations governing their capital and their liquidity, and they have a thing called a liquidity coverage ratio, which they must meet and so on. So they have that, but it's really about, if you're a CEO of a bank, it's really about putting together a business story to demonstrate you're rock solid. Because even if you get deposit flight, you'll have enough kind of other things within the firm to hold it. Like, people move money when they can't see a way out for the bank. What happened with Silicon Valley is they put all that money in US treasuries. Brilliant, very safe, right? But when interest rates are very low, then those treasuries The mark to market on many of them, if they had to sell them, they would have to sell them at a loss. And when interest rates are low, the price of bonds rises. And as interest rates started to edge up, the price of bonds fell off. And that was really the problem. But so there's nothing other than building a solid business and not being over-reliant on one group of clients, one group of depositors, or one business model. You don't see people getting so worried about the top flight Wall Street investment banks that have, you know, that feed into money markets at different levels, because, you know, it's concentration risk that worries people. And that's an eggs in the basket thing, something we might have learned when we were young at school. But strangely enough, there are businesses that are very reliant on one part of the economy, and that's where the fright can come from. I wouldn't recommend bringing in more regs. I mean, I was at a conference before Christmas, and this came up in London. I think most people concluded that we have enough regulations, but we might need better oversight. So I think the regulators were a little bit asleep at the wheel here, and I think they need to be more on it, because the big story here is that a small bank indirectly brought down a large bank. In the old days, a small bank might have brought down another small bank, but you wouldn't normally see that happening. So I think working within the rules more effectively is the answer.
You mentioned that the role of AI as well, and I'm curious, since you spent so much time in your previous career working in capital markets, what do you see in terms of AI in the capital market space, other than what I presume would be a number of products to help you solve the trading problem? Is there anything that's sort of more mid-layer, or, you know, sort of that the deeper layer, where you've seen some great use cases of AI within that space?
Yeah, well, look, that now we're on to the area that I do focus on most. And firstly, you're right. This isn't, you know, it isn't brand new for banks. We've had algorithms doing foreign exchange trading for a very long time. You know, people will be familiar with chatbots talking to their, you know, their high street bank. And we, and all of these things are, they're more machine learning than AI, although they cross into AI. But the real big change, as you know, in the last year was Gen AI, which takes it to another level entirely. And I think 23 was a big year, as I say, because banks really woke up to the fact that this is a game changer. So what I'm seeing happening now is, I'm aware, speaking to entrepreneurs and others, that there's an awful lot of pilot cases happening below the scenes. The big banks are running, I saw some digital bonds go through the market recently. These are bonds that they're just the same as any other bond that you'd see in the bond market, but it's on a distributed ledger like blockchain. That's how it's a digital token is how they sell the bond. Hong Kong, the government of Hong Kong was in the market quite recently. I saw Hitachi, I saw ABN AMRO. But when I looked closer at these bonds, they were quite small. Very small compared to what, you know, most of these players would go out in the high hundreds of billion, you know, sorry, high hundreds of millions, or over, you know, for sovereigns, it could be over a billion and so on. And so they're doing test balloons to see how this technology works, to play around with the mechanics of it, because they know it's coming. But if it all goes wrong, it's a small-ish deal. Now, that's one thing that I think most frequent issuers in the bond market are playing around with in one form or another. I just call them blockchain bonds, but they don't all run on blockchain, but it is a distributed ledger of some kind. Now, you know, the thing that really caught my eye is the job I used to do, you know, debt origination, which is, I was the guy who would go to the client and do a PowerPoint presentation and explain to them why it is we should raise a sum of money. I specialize in a thing called hybrid capital. That's a Google for your listeners if they can't sleep some night, but it'll be a distraction if I go into too much. But it was basically a bond, and that required days of preparation. We'd have to run the numbers of the bank. We'd have to model it for this new bond. We'd have to retire the old bond, figure out what that would cost, have a confident view on interest rates, we'd have to talk them through the investors, who we'd sell it to, how long it would take, documentation, huge. Now, we were well set up to do it, but I could probably manage two of those in a week on a good day. Now, I'm reading about the Gen AI can put together these pitch books in no time. And I'm lamenting all the sleep I lost in the noughties, because if they had that back then, life might have been very different for me. But I think, and then what does that mean? That means that goes to productivity. So if you can knock out, say, 20 of these in a week, you could see four clients a day for 5 days. Whereas we, at that level of detail and pitch, we could see two, three. There was only, I think it's very interesting, just before Christmas, the law firm Allen and Overy launched a AI-driven documentation mechanic or unit whereby all the parties to a transaction can edit it in real time, and there's an immutable record of what took place, the various iterations. It basically cuts down, you know, documentation is a huge part of deal doing. My deals took about 6 weeks of docs before we got to market. It looks like, I'd say this could get down to a day, overnight maybe.
We all become just editors of the AI output.
Yeah, we'll oversee it. And I think it's, to some extent, it's what airline pilots have been doing for years. You know, those algorithms are doing the heavy lifting, and they're there to make sure everything works. And that's very safe. So I think asset management, there's huge effort going in there to robo trading and wealth tech, they're calling it. So these guys I mentioned earlier, Credit Suisse, your Morgan Stanleys, all these guys, you know, very wealthy people from your part of the world, who entrepreneurs and so on, go to these guys to have their money managed. And they get charged a princely sum. But now, tests show that a well-programmed robot can manage your money just as well, if not more effectively. And so they have to reinvent themselves. What's our offering to these people? If it, you know, just you get a cup of coffee and a leather folder for your checkbook, but you know, a lot of money could be saved there. And I know people who were worried about their jobs in that business. I think fractional real estate, I know you covered this a few weeks ago with one of your guests, which is where tokenization of commercial real estate. I thought that was interesting, because tokenization of those kind of assets is something that's going to be in wealth management and in consumer investments. I don't know if you've ever had the pleasure to, I certainly, if you ever invest in a fund that's property, you run the risk of it being gated in downtime, so you can't get your money out until they sell a building. If digitalization and fractional real estate takes off, a big property portfolio can just sell, I don't know, 5% of a Manhattan skyscraper if they need cash, whereas right now you got to sell the whole building or nothing, right?
So the blockchain proponents have been talking about this for a while. What do you think the holdup is? Is it like a technical issue in terms of keeping it secure, or what do you think the major roadblock is?
So mostly these are digital tokens sold on digital exchanges. There's a lot goes into it. I mean, there was a Manhattan skyscraper going back, I'm going to say around about 2018, I think 19 was done. But everything I talk about, everything that's happening in AI today comes up against the same things. On the one hand, I did this online course with Harvard there some years ago, and it was fascinating because you learned about these tech entrepreneurs straining at the leash, making all these wonderful inventions and taking the world in an exciting direction. But last summer, just to get the other side, I went and I went to the wonderful College of Europe in Bruges, fascinating place, to learn about the legislation, the Digital Markets Act, the things that are happening in Europe that slow it down. So if you imagine, like, I see it almost like the parachute on a car, you know, that's trying to break a land speed record, and then they at least, you know, slow it down at the end. Regulation, tax, accounting are the principal things, and law are the principal things that will come into play when these things move into the big time, when they move from kind of pilots, or you might have a new app that does something that was never done before, and it's fine. But if you're trying to take a huge conglomerate bank and kind of moving on to an entirely new platform, there is a myriad of regulations and rules that it'll have to comply with, some of which haven't been written. And I think it's the good old fashioned stuff that will slow it down. But I think if we get it right, it's a bit like the pedal of brake in a car. You know, if you get it right, you proceed safely at a reasonable pace.
Then you'll see the rush of everyone following through.
If you've got a Revolut account or something and someone pings you money, you have it in 2 seconds, right? If you're in the bond market, it's still very old fashioned. Like, you know, you do this huge trade, you spend months doing it, the big day arrives and you launch the bonds into the marketplace. So there's a client out there looking to raise, say, 500 million. And they won't have that the next day. It's the trade date, and they're trying to get it down. But let's say 3 days is standard. Now, there's been talk of T plus zero for years to get this down to, you know, you do your trade and you get your money just like it would happen on a banking app. But I was in Europe and I had an opportunity to, because I did some work for the European Commission, and I had a meeting with the Director General. They've wonderful titles over there for departments. So the DG that looks after capital markets in Brussels was explaining to me that they've been monitoring this, and that there's a whole block of legislation that covers trading, and there's a whole block of the trading of the launch of a bond, and there's a separate block of legislation that covers settlement, which is when one party gets bonds and the other party gets money. And whilst technically you can smash together trading and settlement more easily, the legislation being smashed together, you can just guess how long that would take and what problems it would throw up for all parties. So I think we're getting there. The direction of travel, I'm very confident in. But you know, I'm looking at a picture here of a train with a clock on the platform in London, and I'm reminded Londoners instinctively understand this, that you know the train's coming, but you don't know when. And I think that's, those things will hold it up, but we shouldn't, you know, somebody said to me recently, whatever happened to blockchain? We were all talking about that a few years ago. That's gone away. It's like, it's so not gone away. It's just that there are many things that are, they've gone underwater a bit to be developed.
Yeah, I feel like I'm being impatient, but
you know, no, it's good. Yeah, we all are. There's also agreed protocols. For a start, there's roughly 130 trillion bonds out there in the marketplace, dollars. So if everyone starts doing blockchain bonds tomorrow, that's fine. But what do you do with the ones outstanding? Some of these bonds, you know, 10-year bonds, some of them 30-year bonds. How do you get them? Because they were done before this came along. So do you have a twin track? New bonds? Because what you really want is a one big liquid market where everyone can trade freely. So that's an issue, legacy securities, what to do with them. And then there's the protocols, and it starts getting into very technical space here. But I know, for example, that the International Capital Markets Association has brought out what they call bond data taxonomy. Now, don't ask me how that all works, but that's basically the language that all of the components of a bond have to be written in: the interest rate, the tenor or the length of the bond, the various clauses. Because if everyone ends up doing digital bonds on different platforms with slightly different protocols, then we've also failed, because you haven't got this lovely liquid interchange.
Yeah, that's the nightmare scenario.
Yeah, so there's an awful lot going on. But, you know, But there is stuff going on, which I think is the story. There is a lot going on, even if it doesn't feel that way on first glance.
Speaking of a lot going on as well, I'm also curious because there seems to be, you mentioned earlier, the example of really shortening the work that a banker would do in capital markets thanks to AI, right? And we see that across all industries. What do you see as sort of the future in terms of employment and staffing in general from an AI perspective in capital markets and in banking more broadly?
It's a very good question, and it's a debate that, you know, Sam Altman and Elon Musk are on opposite sides of to some degree when I've heard them speak on it. My view, you know, tech disrupts rather than destroys jobs. So I think I do not see all employment going, but I do see like all of the breakthroughs, whether it was the motor car or the you know, industrial weaving machines of you know, of yesteryear and so on.
Or even the computer. There's a lot less secretaries and file clerks.
Exactly. Yeah, and people who got hit in almost
a typing
every
pool
to date.
Where are the typing pools these days?
Well, they're you know, PAs in the city on Wall Street do very well. So they, you know, you got to just pivot to new skill sets and
Exactly. There's a lot more Java engineers. Yeah.
Yeah, but for example, I should point out, having said all that, you know, if I look at accounting, for example, Deloitte, PwC, you know, all the big four accounting companies have announced redundancy programs. Deloitte, before year end, launched.
That's layoffs for our American listeners.
Say that again, sir.
That's layoffs for our American listeners.
Layoff. You correct me when I get that wrong.
But, well, I'll translate for you.
Yeah, perfect. But the point is that people are going to lose their jobs for definite. And they, interestingly, launched their own proprietary, a bit like the Alan Overton, they launched a chatbot for the internal employees who just do the first cut of client presentations and other things. However, I did a blog recently on a thing called a prompt engineer, which I'd never heard of until I discovered they were getting six-figure salaries.
I love that job title and the whole thing.
Yeah, it's a great job.
Hilarious. Yeah.
And it reminded me that at my children's school recently, at a parents' night, we were told that 60% of the kids at school today will end up doing jobs that haven't been invented yet. So
that's been true for a few decades now, yeah?
Yeah, well, they keep saying that. But like, I'm of the school of mind that definitely there'll be disruption. Definitely jobs will change. And I think people preparing for the employment market now need to be prepared to have a number of careers and to be very flexible and to kind of invest in re-education and so on. But I cannot see a world where people are just sitting at home and there's bots doing everything. It just doesn't.
Yeah, it changes. I remember when I was in third grade, I told my parents I wanted to be a podcaster.
Oh, really?
And they didn't know what that was.
And they were like, what's a podcast?
I know. I said that once at a conference about hybrid capital, and I got the same laugh. It you don't know what you'll end up doing. I never heard of hybrid capital before. I ended up making a career out of it. But I will add, though, that there are people very worried, and I've gotten feedback from quite senior people at banks, you know, that I've approached to kind of pick their brains on the future of all of what we've just discussed today. And they kind of listen politely, and then they kind of ask me about jobs. You know, they're thinking about, and normal that they should be. And I'm thinking, where are the visionaries? Where's the guys who are going to take this to a new place? And so I think it's the...
You're talking to them.
The VPs, and yeah.
Exactly. Yeah. You know, one area that we saw maybe in the past 3 years or so was the growth of ESG, or actually 3 to 5 years. The growth of ESG-focused investments from a banking side as well. But that seems to be, at least in the U.S., which is where we sit, of course, that seems to have taken a bit of a backseat now. Do you see that investments, or rather, taking into account ESG metrics in investments, something that will continue in, you know, maybe more in Europe or less in the U.S.? Or sort of, how do you see that ecosystem evolving, you know, as we get away from the hype cycle of ESG?
Yeah, ESG is a very interesting case in hand, because I watched and pitched green bonds, for example, for a long time before they came to pass. And as you know, in this world, we talk a lot about tipping points. To me, I think in 2019, Apple did a monster green bond in Europe anyway, and now every client wants green and so on. And I see the pressure staying there. I think like any ecosystem, it'll evolve and change. And there was a big backlash against greenwashing and all of the rest of it. But I think it's driven by consumers. I think, you know, people investing for their retirement accounts or I think it started with consumers because they were eschewing, you know, fossil fuels and other things.
Of course.
When they would go to their broker accounts and therefore the institutional investors had to react. And there is a big cohort coming up the line that just won't deal with things the way they were. So I do think it's going to stay. I don't think it's a fad, if that's the worry. But there's probably many aspects of the whole kind of interwoven ESG. I mean, I'm mostly familiar with the bond market, and I think green bonds are here to stay. I structured one of the first green hybrid capital bonds out of the Netherlands some years back, and I had to jump through a lot of hoops to make that work. Things have gotten easier now, I think, but that was driven by demand from the clients, and I don't think they thought for a second this was a fad. So I think it's here to stay, but like everything, things are going to go through various iterations. And
right,
like
right.
All entrepreneurs talk about the pivot, they start out setting up a company to do X and they end up doing Y, but it's related. So for what it's worth, I think it's here to stay.
Yeah, yeah. Well, we'll definitely have to have you back to talk about everything we missed, IoT and the newest startups and the results of this discussion. So
yeah,
we're glad you're with us. Keep up the good work.
Yeah, well, you know where I am. And thanks for taking the time. I enjoyed the chat. And yeah, let's stay in touch.
Yeah, sounds good. That's Ronan Donahue, capital markets and AI consultant. Please hit subscribe to keep up with the latest in fintech news. And thank you for listening.